planned a new series, and I think we've got 20 weeks looking at Jesus, and I've got that subject, so Jesus, my chosen servant. So if you've got a Bible, if you can turn to Isaiah 42 and verses 1 to 4. Isaiah 42 and 1 to 4. Just kick the wire out of the way. Where it says this: "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law." So what I want to try and do is just put all that into context, if I may. We're just going to take you on a little bit of background and whistle-stop tour of Isaiah, so that we know where we are and what we're working with and all of that sort of stuff. So the book of Isaiah, if you have it in your hand, is actually divided up into three parts, three books, if you like. In the first section, chapters 1 to 35, it just deals with Isaiah's times, speaking to his contemporaries, speaking about what God wants to say to those contemporaries. And this section actually is against the what they call the Assyrian period. So you've got an Assyrian period where they are in control of the region, and Judah, although very powerful, perhaps wealthy and influential, is actually spiritually quite weak. So what you've got is you've got the Assyrian power, but also Isaiah speaking into those two things at the same time. And as he speaks about those two things, he speaks about the injustice of that period and the injustice that's going on both locally and globally, and that although that is occurring, that God is looking for righteousness and he's looking for justice, and he sees the cry of the oppressed. And Isaiah predicts that what will happen is if that is not satisfied, that God will intervene. And I love it because there's this phrase, I don't know if anybody's seen it in Isaiah, it said, "He will whistle for Assyria." Which just shows you've got this massive nation called Assyria, and God sees them as a little dog. Yeah. And goes, and Assyria comes and acts against Judah. And you think, wow. So big Assyrians, big Assyria, but actually big dog. Big dog? No, big God. That's the right way around. So, yeah, that was a classic dyslexic slip. What did that was? And the Assyrians actually will be the stick that God uses to correct his people. Because if God's people don't listen, God will use other means so that God's people will listen. So he uses the Assyrians, and in the opening chapters of Isaiah speaks about the problems that will exist in the nation and about the judgment that's coming. So that's the first part. The second part of the book is 36 to 39. It's just what they call a historical bridge. And I don't really want to go into all of these things, else we'll never get onto it. But it sort of introduces at least of one of the causes of the Babylonian captivity that Judah will get itself into. So we get that. And then we get the third section, which is where we are. You have to cheer at this point. Thank you very much. 40 to 66, and Isaiah speaks about the Babylonian captivity to come. It's actually about 130 years, I think, Paul, after this, hopefully. See, I'm looking to you. You're supposed to nod. You weren't there. Okay. Keith, it's about 130 years after.
And 3 days.
It's 130 years and 3 days after Isaiah was speaking, and he predicts it's coming. And he tells them that this is going to happen. He tells them that this is what the captivity will be like. And he predicts also a regathering to the land and a rebuilding of the temple and a restoration of the nation of Judah. That's what we've got. And he prophesies all these things. So if the theme of the first chapters is condemnation, the theme of its final chapters is comfort. So that's why we get in chapter 40 where it says comfort. Do you remember this? Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, and that she has received from the Lord the Lord's hand double for her sins. So Isaiah prepares God's people for exile well in advance, but he also comforts them in advance. And isn't that like your God? Isn't that like the God that you and I worship? He does tell us that there will be times ahead of us that will be difficult. But he also tells us that there will, that in those times, he will help us. He just doesn't say it's going to be tough out there. He says it's going to be tough out there, and this is the way that I can help you. I can bring comfort to you. So then we zoom in a little bit further, and in chapters 40 to 66, the comfort is introduced. How will this comfort come? How is it that you will be able to be comforted? And Isaiah talks about the one who will bring the comfort, the servant of the Lord. You see, our comfort isn't just in a pillow, it's in a person. It is literally in a physical presence of a person, the servant of the Lord, who will bring salvation and who will accomplish his purposes in the nations. And this is the one who is at the center of Isaiah's thinking. So when you read Isaiah, you have to think that all of the first part of it is leading up to this one thing, the introduction of the servant of the Lord. The answer is the servant of the Lord. So chapters of the he's the one at the middle, and this is the first song. That there are many songs in Isaiah, and this is the first one. And so we are going to zoom in on the first song of the servant of the Lord. Is that okay, Barbara?
Yes.
Okay. Are you with me? Okay. So, just to give you an introduction to chapter 42, chapter 41 is a court. Now, by the look of you, particularly the people from West Bromwich, you've probably been in a court many times. I have been in a court once in my life where I had to represent a company. And I have to say, it is scary. In fact, I've been in twice, haven't I? Twice I went to... Sorry. Once was when I beat Callie, and the other one was the first time that I had to go to court is that my the company that I work for allegedly sold the wrong product. Do you remember me going up to London for that? And the second time that I went to court was when before I was moving up from Sussex. I don't know whether Rachel can remember this, that I was moving up to Rugeley, and I worked for a company just for a small amount of time, trying to sort out some of their management systems, and we had a huge great piece of metal fall from a crane and land on somebody's feet, and it crushed the feet. And I had to go and represent the company who I would just work for in court, of which the guy was, of course, claiming that he would never work again. He actually did never work again. So I know a little bit of the court scene. So God calls the Gentile nations before the bar. I want you all to come and stand before the bar. And God is the judge. Not only is the judge, he's the prosecuting barrister, and he is the jury. He is all things. And he asks the nations to present their case. And what he does is that he brings them from the east and the west. And he brings two classes of of Gentiles to the bar. The ones from the east are from Mesopotamia, and the ones from the Gentiles from the west are the Mediterraneans. So you've got the Mesopotamians and the Mediterraneans. He brings them all to the bar, and this and stands them in a court scene. And God is standing in front of them. And he says, okay, guys, who can bring justice in the world? That's the charge. Answer me. You answer me. And who can affect justice? And who can set things right? And those are the questions that he asks these two groups of people. And he asks them to present their case. Come on, guys. You know, you think you're so big, you think you're so mighty, you think you're so great. Give me your case. And then what he does, wonderfully, is that he says, okay, then, I will give you my case. I will tell you what I have done in history and how that's going to affect salvation. And he asks the nations, how will you set things right? How are you going to set things right? And if you have to remember that Isaiah was writing when there was a number of large empires that were either in the process of being built or already established. So the Assyrians, we know, he's asking them that question. He's asking the Babylonians that question. And actually, at the same time, it was the birth of Rome. Just the beginnings of Rome in Isaiah's time. But it was also the classical period of Greece at the same time, what is often reported as the Golden Age. And God calls these great nations before him, and he asks them, what is the solution to the world then, big guys? What are you going to say? What do you think your answers? How are you going to heal the brokenhearted? How are you going to deal with suffering? How are you going to deal with all the problems of humanity that stretch across the world? And he quizzes them and asks them huge questions. Can you imagine this scene? Big nations, God, the bar, the court, the jury, the barrister, the judge. And they have absolutely nothing to say. So if you put this in context, this is the biggest thinkers in the world today. The big brains, the big clever ones, the ones that you would think, even today, do we not refer to Rome and Greece and we say, these are the big guys. And yet these big guys have stood before the bar of God and they have nothing to say. And their answer is nothing. So God gives his verdict. In verses 28 and 29, he says, but when I look, there is no one. There is no counselor who, when I ask, can give me an answer. Verse 29 in verse 41. Behold, they are all a delusion. Their works are nothing. Their mental images are like empty wind. Wow. They have nothing to say. You can imagine at this point that God has assembled all the great brains. He's asked them the question and they can't answer him. And then there is a moment of silence in the court. They don't have anything to say and God is just waiting. And then God introduces another figure into the courtroom. And he brings somebody in front of the court. And he said, I want to introduce you to the servant of the Lord. I stand before you the answer to the nations of the world, the servant of the Lord. And in first God calls us in verse 29 to behold the nations. And then in verse 20 he said, behold the servant. And he fixes our attention on the one that he has designated as the answer. And this is always, and it always will be, the answer to the world's problems. Fixing our eyes on the servant of the Lord and taking our eyes and our thoughts off the philosophies of man. It's still the same. Nothing has changed. If we think the philosophies of man will save us, then we are mistaken. I don't know whether anybody was listening to the news this morning. We were listening to the news. And I didn't realize that, I suppose just naively, that nations for their own governments make assessments on other governments. So here in the UK, we made an assessment on Donald Trump's presidency and Donald Trump's whatever you call his government. And we wrote it down. And we wrote it down so that we might know and advise people what we are dealing with. And of course, in today's world, it's the day of leaks. You haven't seen it yet, have you? Oh, it's hilarious. So our government, our ambassador actually to America, has made his assessment on Donald Trump and Donald Trump's government. What he thinks about Donald Trump as a person and what he thinks of the government and how he runs his government, and he's put it out there. It's leaked. We have yet to make a comment, meaning we are guilty. So he's made this thing. And he's made this wonderful assessment on both of those things to help our government in dealing with him. And that's what we've done. As if our government know better than their government. And still both governments, whatever you think, are going to have their philosophies and ideas how different governments should rule another one and another one. And actually, we all stand, east and west, before the bar, in front of the judge and the jury and the barristers, and actually we all stand with one thing. Actually, the answer is still enter the servant of the Lord. So, the question... Oh, I've gone the wrong way. So the answer is this. Who then is the servant? It seems very clear, does it not, that the servant is Jesus? Would you agree? Please nod. Okay. How do we know that? The Jews recognized this long before Jesus' time. In their day, if you looked at it in the Hebrew and Aramaic, they inserted between the third and the fourth word in verse 1 the word Messiah. So actually, you should read this. Behold, my servant Messiah. Isn't that amazing? So before Jesus came, the Jews knew whom this verse was referred to, which is why in Matthew, when we read it there, we find out that these words directly refer to Jesus. We're reading about Jesus. We're called to look upon him as the solution to every problem. And the question is this: do you believe that, and do you go to him first? Is he the answer to your difficulty, your trial, your situation? Because that's how it's portrayed here. You'll recognize that immediately that the theme of this section is justice. In 12 lines, he says three times that this one, the servant of the Lord, will bring forth justice. This is the one who will set things right. Now, we're going to just do a little bit of trying to unravel some things. So can you go with me? Okay, here we go. There are two terms that occur frequently in the Old Testament, and they are often found in conjunction with one another. The terms are righteousness and justice. You've probably read that a lot. Yes? Okay, good. The word righteousness in the Old Testament means to bring things into a conformity with a standard or a norm. In other words, you would refer to weights that were accurate as righteous weights. Does that make sense? So there's this dodgy weight, which Ben has when he's weighing out something, or is the correct weight And that correct weight is a righteous weight, as against the dodgy weight, okay? So that's how that means. But also, a tree. Have you read that righteous trees? Have you read about righteous trees in the Old Testament? Okay. Now, the reason for that is in the Old Testament, evergreen trees are described as trees as righteousness because they always look as they ought to look. That's how a tree ought to look. They don't drop the leaves in winter, so they're a righteous tree. And the term basically means to bring things into conformity with the way that it ought to be. This is the right weight. This is the right tree. This is what it looks like. This is how it should be. Does that make sense? We're all right. Okay. In the Old Testament, the standard for the character of God is depicted like this. So righteousness means bringing something into conformity with the character of God. Are you still with me? Okay. And justice is the outworking of that righteousness. So justice is the application of righteousness, is the action by which the king or some other person uses to bring about the state of righteousness in the nation. So the king will apply justice in the nation to bring about the character of God, to make it conform to a particular standard. Okay? With me? Fantastic. Don't ask me about this when we get home. Okay? So when Isaiah says, the servant of the Lord will bring about justice in the world, he's saying he will establish things according to the right standard. He will take things and bring them back to the way they ought to be. Fantastic. That's what Jesus does. He takes something and he brings it and he works on it and he makes it how it ought to be. That's why Jesus is working in our lives, taking what it isn't at the moment and making it into the way that it ought to be. That's why God is working in you. He's making you more like, he's making you into what you ought to be. That means that you and I are not yet what we ought to be. You have to say hallelujah at that point because we're all in work in progress. We're bringing ourselves into the character of God and Jesus is doing that work. Oh, it's lovely. There we go. So whether we're talking about our homes or society or ourselves, it is the servant of the Lord that aligns them into the character and the standard of God. No one else can, and we can't do it without him. We can't do it without him. We need him to help us. So then, in this section, we're told something of how that worked in him and therefore how it works in us. He's the clue. How did he do it when he was on earth? And how do we read that in the Bible? And we have to understand that what worked for him works for us. The connection between him, you and I is eternal, is it not? We are in Christ and Christ is in us. Still with me? It's good. I liked it. Okay. So let's look at his resource. First, let's look at the resources that enable God's servant to bring about justice on the earth. He is described as the servant of the Lord whom the Father upholds. And the term uphold means to take hold of something. It means to strengthen something. It means to take grip upon them. And the best way of describing this is to take either somebody that's frail, that is struggling to walk, or somebody that is learning to walk at both sections and sort of saying that I've got hold of you to help you. But also, it could be just that I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you do this. So that's what uphold means. It means to strengthen. And that's what the Father does or did for the servant. His son. Jesus got his strength because he was fully man from his Father. That's the incredible thing that we need to grasp hold of. We normally think of Jesus, since he's God, as sufficient in himself, but he made himself man by a choice. He laid aside his majesty. And if we hadn't got time, we'd have probably got onto that one, because that was in the 1970s too this morning. So we could have got there. He probably was on the list. We couldn't fit it in. No,
that's
but
next week.
Okay. Yes. But Jesus tells us himself that his strength was derived from the Father. He said that he couldn't do anything without his Father. He said that he was not strong in himself. And of course, what you do know is that he experienced all the limitations of flesh. Yes. He wept. Yes. He got tired. He did all of those sort of things, did he not? So he was human, and yet he did not sin. Therefore, he understands our limitations. Yes. He understands what you and I think or feel when we go, oh, I don't know how I'm going to do that. Not my will, but your will be done. I don't know how I can do this on my own. Even that point. If you go to Gethsemane, that's what Gethsemane is all about. I don't know how I'm going to do this. It's amazing, isn't it? He had to depend on his Father for strength. There was simply no other way that he could carry out his ministry that the Father had given him. So he knows this, that he is upheld by his Father. I am upheld by my Father. In contrast to that, we go back to the court, as it were, and the eastern and western worlds are there, and we get their opinion. So in verse 5 it says, the coastlands, referring to the Gentile, around the Mediterranean, the Romans, if you like, the Greeks, the Egyptians. It says this, the coastlands have seen and they are afraid, and the ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near to come, and everyone helps his neighbor and says to his brother, be strong. Come on, be strong. Do you know, I can say that. If any of you have played football, in a football team or anything like that, I have had that so many times. Surely you can do better than this. Huh? Come on. Come on, you can do better than that, Sheila, can't you? Surely you can. My dad used to say this, but I don't know whether any of the older ones have had this. Perhaps it's a Midland thing. My dad used to say to me, come on, son, pull your socks up. I mean, there are two things when you're a kid. Firstly is, how is that going to help me in school? Because in my head, I'm thinking, by pulling my socks up, my geography is going to improve in school. And I never quite understood that. But if you look at it, this is what we're talking about here. He uses the same term that is found in 42, where the Lord upholds or strengthens it, or takes hold of his servants. All the Western philosophy is shot through with the idea that the way to handle crisis is be strong. Try harder. Get a grip on yourself. Come on. When the tough get going, what is the song? When the going gets tough. What's the song? Thank you, Fleur. Rescued me. What a rubbish song that is. Fleur, do not ever sing that ever again. Because that's the way that we've encouraged one another. You've had a hard day tomorrow. Just be strong. We were laughing yesterday because Callie was emptying a drawer. And in the drawer is all sorts of things from our courting or going out. Which the debate was, when are we going to give these to our kids? So we were looking at this and pointing on. And I used to send Callie a lot of things from Charlie Brown and Peanuts and stuff like that. Do you remember this? In fact, we've got some. At some stage, you will get some of these. In fact, we have got Charlie Brown and Yeah. So I used to send lovies. Did you not do this? Paul, you're looking at me as if you're disturbed now. Did you not say, so love is this and like, do you not remember that in a newspaper when you used to get it in a newspaper? Well, I used to cut them out and send them to Cully.
No, I used to buy posh cards.
Yeah, but I'm from Willenhall. It's worse than... Anyway, in one of those things, you've got to imagine that Peanuts cartoon, Charlie Brown, he goes to Lucy for counselling, which is always a mistake. And she set up a desk, as she's done, and she's got a banner over it, and it says, psychiatry, 5 cents. So Charlie Brown sits down, and he says, Lucy, you know that I've really tried. Tell me I've tried. I have so tried. I've tried, and I've tried, and I've tried to be good. So Lucy looks up. You have to remember these in little squares. He says, nice try, Charlie. 5 cents. Because the world tells you that the answer is to be strong. And God says, no, there's a servant who is upheld, therefore so can we be upheld. Do you know that there is no situation that you are in that cannot be upheld by God? Let me ask you a question. How do you think that Jesus endured the cross? It's a good question asked. There's a theological basis for that, which we won't go into. But it's a good question. Then ask yourself, what are you and I facing? I think there's a supernatural, amazing upholding that comes from the servant of the Lord. So, where have I got to? I have no idea where I've got to. It should be the chosen. So, second, we have to see that my notes are wrong. See, not only we didn't know how to do worship, but we don't know how to preach either. The second one is that the servant is the Father's chosen one. My chosen one in whom my soul delights. Describe that. Describe the soul delighting in Jesus from the Father. Can you get that? That's a bursting in it, aren't there? I think there is so much in that. I have watched my children, sorry, Rachel, I won't mention things, both of them, and now my grandchildren in Christmas plays. And I have to say this, I'm just sorry, but it doesn't matter what they do, but you cry a bit, don't you? It doesn't matter whether you can hear them or not, or whether you can catch them or not. Oh, dear, what was that? That was stuck to me. What was that? That's the secret weapon. Okay. Oh, but I don't know whether you've been like that, but I have been in these situations when we've made costumes and all that sort of stuff, and we've been in there, and there has been a sense of tear and delight. And I think probably when you've seen your niece and you've made the costume, you've put her up there, and she's danced and done whatever, you just think there's something really deep in delighting over your children. And we've watched Rachel and Amy and probably Edward now and Matilda this year of last year in there doing their little things, and they come on and that sort of stuff. We went to sports day last week. Edward is sleeping, so I'm all right. I think he's sleeping. Yes, he's well asleep. So I want you to imagine that Edward is on the front row. And for some reason, all the kids are ready to go. And my grandchild has decided that what he needs to do is be Spider-Man on the floor. Which means that when they go on, your marks get set, go, that everybody else has gone, but we've got the Spider-Man pose absolutely perfectly. It sort of went like, a bit like that, didn't it? Sort of, like this. So on your marks get set, go. He's still doing Spider-Man, they've gone. Do you know? But I was proud. I was proud. I went, that's my grandson. Tim walked away and went, that's my son. There's just something in there, isn't there? This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Describe that. Catch that. But can you catch this? That long before Jesus ever did anything, long before he worked a miracle, long before he died for sin, he knew and was assured of the love and the approval and the delight of his Father. Because it isn't about doing, folks. It is that it is there. What enabled him to endure the rejection of men and the hardship of the cross was because he was assured of this one thing, that he was loved by his Father, and his Father delighted in him. Prophesied here way, way, way before. And of course, the same is true. Do you know, we're not always going to receive the praise of people and the appreciation of people. They won't always understand us because we come from the black country. They go, what? And we won't always delight in, they won't always delight in us. You know, but we, like the Son, are chosen and we are a source of intense delight to the Father. Do you know that? How do you come to the Father? With your head down or your head up? It really does matter. As one carrying the sin or one who has had your sin taken away from you. As one coming to the Father knowing that I come. Do you know that makes a difference? It makes a difference because it matters how you come. Do you come knowing that the one that you're going to speak to delights in you? You come running then, don't you? That's how you come. You come absolutely running. That the one that you, when you start that praying thing and you go, Lord, and he's in heaven, if you could describe that, the heart of heaven beats. Just that little bit faster. Ah, it's my son in whom I am well pleased. Where are we going? How long have I got? 3 hours? We're all right. That's the one I missed. Third, we're told that the servant is empowered because he possesses the Spirit. I have put my Spirit upon him. In the Old Testament, the way that we use in the Old Testament is the Old Testament principle is that the Spirit is the thing that gets things done. That's the way. It's the animating principle. It is God at work. It is God. It's more than a principle. It is the person that helps you to get things done. And I love the descriptions, do you not, in the Old Testament, of wind and breath in the Old Testament. The people, what do? They look and they see the wind at work. The wind is working. The wind is doing something. And this is the way the ministry of the Son is described. He possessed the Spirit empowered him, the Spirit sent him. And it says this, does it everywhere? The wind blew. Because the wind was doing something over here and over there. My neighbour has an issue with wind. That is not a personal issue. And it's not that I know that because I sit next to him. It's because we have a tree in our garden and he maintains that we have that one thing where the blossom comes down. And he always says that the wind comes from down the street, blows the blossom on his two cars. And he says, I have an issue with wind. And because the wind will accomplish what it wants to accomplish. I say to him, God is on my side. I'm the vicar in this. I don't want to sweep my garden, it goes your way. And he just looks at me and he says he doesn't quite understand that. But the wind, Jesus will accomplish what Jesus wants to accomplish. He will affect people's lives. He will powerfully and change attitudes because God is at work. The Spirit works. Somebody else has got wind. Was that you, Mike? Okay. See, and these are the characteristics that they're God. Stop laughing, Mike. The Son is upheld by God. Yeah, he's chosen by God. He's possessed by the Spirit of God. And this was how he could carry out his ministry. But how does this? How does that help us? Okay, I think I should have pressed that, shouldn't I? I've got no idea where I am with all this. Anyway, okay, let's try and make this practical. Verse 1. The last line in verse 1 tells us that because of the resources that he possesses in the Father, he will bring forth justice to the nations. He will set things right. And second verse tells us the way that he will do that. He will not cry out or raise a voice nor make his voice heard in the street. He didn't demand recognition. He didn't publish daily reports in the Jerusalem Times. He didn't talk about what he did. He went about doing what the Father had called him to do. He didn't promote himself. And that's the way that we're going to do it. We're not going to promote ourselves, but we are going to get on with it. So then we go to verse 3. A bruised reed he won't break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. His description, this is a description of the nature of his ministry. The people that he was drawn to, the lives that he was attracted to. Somehow we've fallen into the mistake that we think that God is pleased with the strong, with those who've got it all right, the ones that, you know, can handle all sorts of different things, the ones that are able to cope without, you know, struggle. Have you met those? The ones that struggle, it seems to, I just take it on the chin. We think that God is pleased with these sort of people. We think that he's put off if we admit failures or deficiencies or the fact that sometimes we just feel that we never quite get it right. Do you feel that you never quite get it right? I don't know how long I've been leading churches, 30-something years. I feel like I never quite got it right. I look back and I go, I find it, do you not do that? If only I'd done. If only I'd said. You can look back and you can write those words. And yet I think this is a very graphic picture of the people that God ministers to. I can see in my mind that. Can you see it? A slender reed. Not a big, thick thing. A slender reed. Crushed, half broken, bending over. Or a lamp. In my day, they had what they used to call a piece of flax in it. Do you remember that? Just about glowing. I don't know whether you've ever bought one of the, you know, when Callie's done this, we've bought a candle, because that's what you do you have to have a candle, because candles these days make your house look nice, apparently. So we buy a candle, and I don't know if you've ever done it, and so you've got this great big thing that we've spent a fortune from it, because you know this Jonathan, now you bear it. Once you get married, you buy candles. Okay, comes part and parcel. We should build that into marriage services with this wife and candle, I'd say. And so you buy a candle like this, and so you spent a fortune and you light it, and it just won't go. So what I then do is, I think, I know, I will get the, and I'll channel it out and make like a hole, but then the wax from here goes in and it never goes like this, and it just goes like that. I can honestly say that there have been times in my Christian walk that I've thought this, I am just about alive in terms of my walk with God. Do you know, in our small groups, in our community groups, we should have the ability to go into our groups and stand there amongst our friends without condemnation and say, my candle is just about burning. Please would you pray for me? It shouldn't come as judgment. It should come as just an understanding that actually in life, sometimes what happens is that the reed gets knocked and the fire just doesn't burn as brightly as it should do. And the Lord, and the servant of the Lord comes and he said, I'll prop you up. and I'll fan into flame that smoking flax. Because that's what I'm called to do. It's who I minister to. It's the very heart of me coming. It says this in Mark. It says, and when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Those are the people that God ministers to. In John 14, it says this, don't let your heart be troubled. Meaning that he understood that people's hearts got troubled. I know that. Do you know, sometimes, I don't know whether you do that, I can go on and on and on and on over the same thing. You're adding to it, I must admit. You're adding to it. But do you not do that? I go over and over and over and over and over and over again. Because my heart can get troubled. And I need to learn that a troubled heart attracts him and moves him to compassion. That Jesus understands my troubled heart. In a survey, Rupert, sorry, I've nicked some of your stats. Well, not yours particularly, but from the .gov about mental health. In a survey covering Great Britain, 1 in 6 adults had experienced some sort of neurotic health problem in the previous week. 1 in 6? Last week. Most common neurotic disorders were anxiety and depressive disorders. More than 1 in 10 people are likely to have a disabling anxiety disorder at some stage in their life. And we need to make sure that they are safe in our church. It's estimated that 13% of the adult population will develop a specific form of anxiety or phobia at some point in their lives. Large-scale studies have suggested that 2.5% of people are likely to experience OCD at some point in their life. I'm like that when the toilet roll is not the right way around. A recent World Health Organization study compared depression with angina, asthma, diabetes, and concluded that the impact of depression on a person's functioning was 50% more serious than the impact of any of the 4 physical conditions. Incredible, isn't it? I've got to be very careful here because I've got some medical people in front of me. .gov, so I'm all right. At present, 40% of disability worldwide is due to depression and anxiety. And the most recent psychiatric morbidity survey indicates that there are more than 6 million in the UK, approximately 3 million with depression as their primary problem, and 3 million with an anxiety disorder. Incredible, isn't it? Who has an answer? You and I have an answer to this. 25% of those with a common mental health problems are currently receiving treatment for it. This falls to just 15% with mixed anxiety and depression. The most common anxiety-related diagnosis, 1.7 more of the population of England, 15% compared with 13.3, were experiencing anxiety-related common mental health disorder in 2007 compared with 1993. This is a percentage rise of 12.8% over 14 years. 800,000 more UK adults would have to be qualified, Rue, for the diagnosis of anxiety disorder in 2007 than in 1993. So in between 19 and 93, to be able to treat this problem, they needed 800,000 and they haven't got it. They haven't got it of their room. It's not there. But the truth be known, we all live with troubled hearts. All of us. All of us are broken reeds, despite the front that we put up. What's your front? What's my front? What do you want to portray to people? How do you make sure that people don't get near to you? I don't want them to get near me. What are your barriers? And actually, if we were honest with one another and said, look, at times I am but a smoking flax and I'm broken reed, then we know that we can be a help to one another, and more than that, the servant of the Lord will help and fix us. To fan us back into flame, to prop us up, to seek out the floundering and the struggling and to minister them. And Isaiah says, he will faithfully bring forth justice. He will do it. He will do it. I'm nearly through. How will he do it? Verse 4, the servant of the Lord. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice on the earth and the coastlands wait for his law. The term translated discouraged is the same word that's found in the second line of verse 3, the dimly burning wick, or the same translation as bruised in the first line. The point is this, that though the servant ministers to the bruised and the crushed, he himself is never bruised or crushed. He doesn't catch the disease. He doesn't give up. He doesn't get faint-hearted. He doesn't tire. He doesn't say to you and me, Jonathan, you and I have been here before. Stuff you. I've tried this 20 times. You have not listened to me 20 times. So I'm off. I'll go and find somebody else. He doesn't say, Keith, I'm going to stop forgiving you now, Keith. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, you have had your bucket load of forgiveness that is allocated to you, and you have just come to the top of it. How many times? Come on, church. How many times have you and I said, here I am, back again, doing the same thing? And Jesus says, no, I will bring justice. I'll bring it to you. There's never a time that we have walked away from the grace of Jesus and the grace of God. And that's the ministry that was given to the servant. He was submissive to the will of the Father. He's the one that ministers to our needs. He had all the resources from the Father to bring about justice. He did it quietly. And he ministers to the weak and the lowly and the oppressed and the downtrodden. And he laid us a pattern that is the way that we should treat people. That's the pattern for our lives. Do we treat each other in the same way that Jesus treats us? When we were doing the Timothy things, it was just a verse that I underlined in my Bible. And it was this. It says, and the Lord's servant, meaning me, must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, patiently enduring, and correcting his opponents with gentleness. And I felt that a real challenge, personally. But when you read that, is that not the way that Jesus has treated us? The Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone. Yeah, I think that matters. It matters that I'm called to act like him, called to speak like him, called to behave like him. Why? Because it's that changes things. It's when we are like him that's where our breakthrough goes. I was listening to a story this week, sitting in somebody's front room, and they told me a story, and it simply went like this. The person said to me, I was in this place here and I was about to leave. And I walked out into the rain. and somebody came after me. And they stood next to me in the rain and said, I won't let you go. I won't let you go. And I think that's Jesus. That is Jesus. That's how Jesus comes. It's there it is. Because what he said is that I won't let this bruised reed bend over forever. And I won't let this smoking flax go out, even in the rain. So I want you to remember the servant of the Lord is there for you. And you have his undivided attention. He's there for you.